Good evening, everybody. My name is Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How y'all doing? It is a great pleasure to be back here again, and I want to wish Earl the best. I look forward to this meeting because this group in the Washington area, I think, has one of the highest spirit levels and caring and, you know, what sort of epitomizes Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a real thrill to come out here and see this. When I think back when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, the groups were much smaller. And, God, as I look back, Annandale Saturday Night Live was about the only place you could laugh, you know. Well, I don't know what was going on. There was sort of a sobriety is grim, but hang in there approach to... That still goes on in New England. I've been up there. I think this joy of living thing sort of swept across the country and made a turn and is working its way slowly up that way, but it stopped in Connecticut. And when you get to Boston, it's still sobriety is grim and hang in there. Maybe you'll survive, you know. But here we get a sort of, for me, what is so important about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope if there's, I saw a few new people getting chips, that you'll really watch what's going on here tonight and come to understand that there's something magnificent in this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's yours for the asking. You just get your hand out and you're going to get things you never dreamed of. And I really believe something I heard early on at a convention in Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard a speaker and I puzzled over this for the longest time, but I've come to believe it's a wonderful thing to wrestle with. And it says, if you're in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're not happy, you're doing it wrong. And that's a very heavy sentence, because it puts it all on my shoulders. And it has nothing to do with your job or your health or your relationship today, or whatever else we are attributing our lack of serenity and peace of mind and happiness to at the moment. I know I was a great inventory taker, and I was always taking inventory as to what was causing me a problem. I never inventoried myself. I inventoried the world around me, and I felt it was my responsibility. I really thought I was a reporter. And I reported to anyone who would listen how things were going. And I thought if I reported well enough, somebody would straighten it out. You know, my mother, my father, teachers, Marine Corps, in the marriages, you know, you just go, I'd like to report that this marriage isn't making me happy. Let me list the ways that it isn't working. And when you get it straightened out, call me back and I'll report again on how well you're doing. You know what I mean? I just, when you have self-centeredness in the extreme, this is how you see life. You just see what is causing you pain, and then you figure it's your job to report to somebody, the government or somewhere. And if you report accurately enough, they'll straighten it out. And so my function mainly was just to keep reporting in about pain. You know what I mean? Like, hello, hello, I feel a little anxiety. Hello, 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 hello. And I figured somebody somewhere was in charge of this, and they would get this thing straightened out. And so taking inventory is not a new thing. Taking my own is relatively new. That was a rather novel approach to life, but of course all of Alcoholics Anonymous has been a novel approach to life, one that never occurred to me to do. So if you are new, you may think that you're just coming here to get sober, but there's one other thing. There's one other thing. I heard this too, and I agree with it, that it's a two-part program. All you do is don't drink and change everything there is about you. Those two little things, and that's about it. It's a fairly simple program.
happen.
Now, we say change everything there is about you. We're not talking about grow tall, become a blonde, all of those things. We're talking about something more difficult to change for alcoholics. It'd be real easy if all you had to do was change from 5 foot tall to 6'6". That would be relatively easy. What they're asking us to do in AA is, as far as self-centered alcoholics are concerned, goes beyond that. They suggest, much to our chagrin, that we change our mind on various things. You come in here and you go, you know, well, hi, I'm going to go to a few meetings, but I don't need a sponsor. They go, well, what we suggest is that you change your mind on that position of not needing a sponsor. I don't like to change my mind on things. It shows. Yes, it does show that you don't like to change your mind. Well, why don't you go ahead and change your little mind? All right, I'll change my mind on that. I'll get a sponsor, but I'm not going to do the steps. I can tell you that right now. I can tell you that. Well, what you ought to do is change your mind about not doing the steps. All right, well, I'll do the steps, but I'm not going to believe in God. You're certainly not going to ask me to go that far, are you? And, you know, I remember when I was putting up this great fight about the concept of God, I thought I was still in a bar room. You remember how you'd get into discussions in a bar room after four drinks and you'd turn to the guy next to you and you'd go, what do you think about this God stuff? That's a good guy to ask. You know what I mean? And then he comes back with the answer you've been wanting all along anyway. Well, I don't think there's much to it myself. Seems to me religions have caused more damage than good. I'll drink to that. Thank you very much. You know, and we had these great, wonderful discussions of those things, and so we get into AA, and that's, for a lot of us, was the only thinking that I had ever done as a grown-up. Grown-up age-wise, certainly not emotionally, but the only thinking I had ever done was to dismiss God, because all through the drinking years, I don't know about you, but that was the one thing I could never shut up, was a little voice that showed up every so often. And you'd be sitting on your bed in the middle of the night, and this little voice would go, your whole life is a mess, you're doing it wrong, you ought to stop all this stuff and get your act straightened out. And my desire was to permanently shut that voice up, because I figured if I could permanently shut that voice up, then I could live any way I wanted and have peace of mind. And since I knew I couldn't change the way I was living, since I was powerless over alcohol, I didn't know I was admitting that, but I knew that I couldn't straighten out, the least I could do would be to shut up this little voice. And I think that's what I was pursuing all along in drinking, was trying to find out a way to get peace of mind through alcohol, which would be to, as it turns out, to kill the very best in us. But getting back to the debate that I, when I talk about changing our mind, when I was confronted probably in the first year or so, you know, that, gee, other people in here are talking about God rather freely. There's no embarrassment. You get up here, well, God, what's going on? And you got steps with God's name in there, and it was real hard to avoid it. There was a smaller crowd within the fellowship who had a simpler program, and it involved don't drink, go to meetings. And I liked that. That seemed like a better program than the 12 steps. I just put the plug in the jug and go to meeting. That's all you have to do. Don't get to screw your life up with all of this other change. And what you end up with is a person with 5 years sobriety and slightly worse off than when they were drinking. Very interesting product. The only thing that's different is this alcoholic doesn't smell bad. That's about the only change. And you go to that alcoholic's family and you go, isn't AA wonderful? And they say, it doesn't work worth a damn. So there is some change involved, and I suppose the fundamental one concerns God or higher power. And I had a big book that my sponsor had insisted that I buy. And as soon as I bought it, I brought it home because I knew my sponsor, and he wasn't going to just, be satisfied that I bought it. He would be curious if I read it. So I opened it in 15 different places and rumpled some pages and put my hand in, with some sweat. I underlined a lot of little things, and put "wow" next to a couple sentences. And freely left it lie around in case anybody wanted to pick it up and look at it in my absence, just to see if, I was into the program. I didn't want to tell him that my entire program was going to consist of "don't drink and go to meetings," because he'd get upset. And in getting my big book arranged that way, I noticed that there was a chapter to the agnostic. Those of you that are new, you're hearing this, your ears are probably picking up a little bit. Aha! Good news. In the midst of all of this spirituality, there's a breath of fresh air, a chapter to the agnostic. And I remember seeing that in the index or on the top of one of the chapter pages, and I went, good deal. Now, I also have a talent of knowing what's in a chapter without reading it. It saves a lot of time. Other people have to go ahead and read the damn stuff, and that uses up a lot of their day, whereas some of us just know what's in there without reading it at all. And I knew that what was in that chapter was how people in AA stay sober who are agnostics. And so when push came to shove, I would pull that chapter out and use that as my program as opposed to all of this stuff, because I could tell that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was going to involve some change. And this was not what I had in mind. I wanted to just go to meetings and not drink. Well, there came a time when I read that chapter, and I'll share with you, if you're new, what that chapter says. I think I can tell you in three words what the chapter of the agnostic says. Change your mind. That's what the chapter says. Oh, you're an agnostic? Hey, change your mind. And it's almost like it cuts off intellectual freedom. You ever notice how AA seems to take away all your rights? We have a second step. It says, restore us to sanity. Let me share with you what I think that means. Some of us want to defend our right to be miserable. And we go to great lengths. We might even get a lawyer. Right? Some guy from the VA sued AA, defending my right to not change. Every man, woman, and child in this country, if they want to, has a right to stay screwed up. And I'm going to focus my energy on defending rights. That's the second step. That's what the second step is talking about. Later on, when you sober up and you look back how funny that is, you realize you need to be restored to sanity when you are lying and puking every day and you're willing to put your life on the line to make sure you can keep doing that. You know what I mean? In some noble cause of the basic American principle, the right to puke. Don't want these people coming in, brainwashing me into having a nice, decent life. Freedom comes ahead of that. You know, and we get a whole sense of priorities that are kind of screwed up, and that's the way, in the beginning, I remember reacting to this program. And I feel very fortunate, and the problem is, when we're doing things like that, we're in a debating mood. You know, half of getting sober is stop the debate. Because obviously we're debating with ourselves. Am I going to do this? Am I going to do that? And we can win any debate we want with ourselves. We just cave in. It's called rationalization. And I guess the gift, when I look back on it, what is the gift that I have that enabled me to have all the wonderful things that have come my way in Alcoholics Anonymous? And they all came almost in spite of me. And I suppose the greatest gift that I've been given in my life is my alcoholism. It is the weakness in my being that is so devastating that I had to ask for help. In that area, I had to ask for help. I had to end the debate and admit that I was powerless over alcohol. And the second I did that, I became savable. Up until then, I could keep all of the help in the world away from me. I think that's what the power of choice is. I have the power to block out all the love in this room. I have the power, the choice, to block out the love of my family, the love of all the people who want to help me. Alcoholics did that all through their drinking. We have the ability to reject all of this help on the grounds that we don't want to give up control of our lives. And thank God for the alcoholism that just kept tightening the noose. You know what I mean? One more time back in the place, you know, and sober enough one more time, one more seizure. You know, and then, man, if this keeps up, I'm going to have to chicken out and ask for help, you know. Back into the firing line one more time. No, I'm not going to chicken out, damn it, I'm going to make it. Out there, one, boom, another seizure or whatever the hell's happening, you know. Oh, they're getting close now. God, I hate to quit. I hate to quit. I'm going to look so bad when I quit. You know that feeling? Everybody's going to jump up and boo me. Oh, he quit. Boo. You know, and little did I know, they're all praying that I'll quit. Praying that I'll throw in the towel. Please quit, please quit. And then we can love you and we want you. And I'm just going, I'm going to look bad if I quit. So I'm going to keep hanging in. It was a tremendous incorrect perspective on everything, and a lot of it came from drinking, and a lot of it came from not growing up. That's the problem. I think that in my case, I started drinking around age 19, which is a very late start. Since I've been in AA, I see people with 5 years sobriety at age 19. And but back then, that's when I started. I can't change my story, but I tried to make up for lost time. And in 15 years, I managed to get all the goodies like malnutrition and nut wards and seizures and so on down. So I was thorough, but not as long-standing as some people. The thing that alcohol did is fairly standard as far as I'm understand this illness. It gave me answers that it didn't give to non-alcoholics. I've had a chance to talk to some of my friends who were my roommates in college, who were good drinkers, good heavy drinkers, whatever you want to call it, but not alcoholics. And if I asked them what alcohol did on that first night in 1949 that they had their first drink along with me, why, they said, oh yeah, drinking, it's sort of the, I still feel the same way I did back then. Drinking is a way to unwind at the end of the day. Drinking is a way to socialize with some friends in kind of a special way. Drinking is a way to just add a little bit to the evening. So drinking has always been a good friend and an important part of my life. These are heavy drinkers. Now comes me, the alcoholic. And if you would ask me, what did drinking do to you? I said, drinking? Drinking is the secret to life. That's an entirely different answer than those other guys gave. But we all poured it down together, and I didn't know they weren't getting the secret to life. I just assumed that we all sat there and just went, my God, the secret to life. I pour this in, I know how to dance. I pour this in, I know how to go around and introduce people to one another and how to seat people at a table and how to say, hello, Mr. So-and-so, in protocol and social graces. All of it is right in here, and it's only a dollar and a half. You know how much a finishing school is? So it just, I don't know how it could give me all these answers. I don't know how. I thought it was coming from the alcohol. And really what was happening was the alcohol was eliminating the fear. And when the fear was gone, my own creative mind was able to work, and I was able to come up with answers and certain things that were appropriate. But then, after a few more drinks, it shut the system down completely, and we behaved in a rather bizarre fashion. But there was a, what I call an envelope of behavior, you know, in there. Right out of the space age, right? There was an envelope of behavior somewhere between drink 2 and 4 when the system was correct. There was just the right amount of chemical in there to get all this information lined up correctly. And my nervousness was gone, and my brain was working. And for about 30 minutes, I was doing fine. Then the chemical thing got screwed up again, and we got turned around, and I got extra confidence and less knowledge. You know how that went, and you got much stronger than you really were. You three guys, come over here. I'm going to beat you up. So it was, you know, and after getting your teeth knocked out and beat up, I remember the first rationalization. That's funny, I hadn't thought about this in a long time, but I think of my first year drinking up in New Haven, Connecticut. That's my hometown. I went to the university there. And we used to drink down, and there's mostly an Italian town and great pizza places and all these guys. Some of them were fairly tough. And I remember one night being out in an alley, a guy had a knife right up against my throat and was suggesting a few things, and I was agreeing with him even though I was drunk as could be. But they had gotten me, come up to the bar and grabbed me by the hair and yanked me off the bar stool and took me outside. And the next day, I was terrified, and I'm like, oh, and I'm thinking all this stuff through. And one of the thoughts that came into my mind was, don't drink anymore. And I almost fainted from that thought. It may be serious, but it's not that bad. That's probably an emotional answer. Let's get our intellect involved in this problem. Let's think our way through this situation. Let's go back over the evening and review the bidding. Ha ha, I think I have it. I will get a crew cut. Oh, more yanking me off the bar stool by my hair. And those are the kinds of answers, because obviously, without knowing it, I had decided that alcohol was the answer. You know what I mean? Now, when you decide that, you may not know it, but I had. I had decided that alcohol for me was the answer and always would be. And so, and it's just like when we come into AA, we decide AA is the answer. The 12 steps are the answer, and my job is to get better at them and to work them into my life as well as I can on a daily basis. And back then, I put the same decision, you know, like the third step of alcoholism. I made a decision to turn my life over to the care of vodka, as I understood it. And, you know, you go through the whole thing, and you come out the other end, and you get the 14 promises of vodka. And it would remove financial insecurity, fear the past would leave us, we would intuitively know how to handle situations that used to back all those things. And they came true in a wonderful sense. The only difference was this higher power that I had didn't love me. That's the main difference between vodka and the higher power found in AA. That vodka may have produced certain feelings that gave me certain things, but it wasn't reliable, and it was a chemical after all. But it was the only one I had going, and I had, without knowing it, made a decision that somewhere in drinking would lie all of the answers, and my job was to learn how to drink better. And so we start the fantastic journey of alcoholism with all of its geographic cures. You remember that? You just get going, something's wrong here, you know. Well, if I could just get to Dallas and start drinking down in Dallas, everything would be all right, you know. And we go around, but we're not going to make a fundamental change to not drink, because drinking is my fuel. Drinking was my power. This is where I got the power to live. this is where what I had faith in. Without realizing, I had actually turned my life over to alcohol, and I was not interested in other answers. I had great faith in alcohol. I think back on it, I didn't realize what a commitment I had to drinking. I could be calmed down by looking out the window. You know, you're going into a meeting, it's 10 in the morning, you're shaking, you're nervous, you're hurting, and you're just going, oh, and the system needs a little drink, and you go, well, if I could just get it fixed. And I remember going to a meeting one time, and I could look out the window in the parking lot and see my car, and in the trunk was a quart of vodka. And just knowing that the quart was right there made me feel better. You know what I mean? I didn't even drink it, and I got calmed down. It was like, oh, isn't that nice? And even after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know if anybody else in this room has done this, I had a $50 bill folded up in my wallet just in case AA didn't work. I mean, a guy has to be practical, right? I mean, you know, you're here, you know, but as long as you got this, then if everything really went to hell, you could take it over to the package store and get straightened out. I mean, I just could not detach my emotional, physical, and spiritual dependency on alcohol. My career, if you will call it, was in the Marine Corps, and I know I've mentioned this out here almost every year, and I was flying their airplanes for a living. And that was my job on a daily basis, was to go out and fly these things, and it was very exciting, and I had a lot of funny stories that I could tell about flying around in airplanes. But none of them has anything to do with the progression of alcoholism. If I had been a truck driver, or if I had been a school teacher, or if I had been, you name it, my story would be essentially the same, except I would have been earning my money with some other profession, and I would have been telling the same lies instead of telling a Marine colonel that I had to go someplace that I really wasn't going, and writing down lies that I had told. I would have been telling the principal of the school where I was going, and you know, but I would have had to lie, I would have had to do all the things that I did. And so I don't think that being a pilot or whatever your profession or hobby or whatever you were into doesn't have anything to do with the alcoholism. This was an inside job. It was destroying me from the inside out, and was making the world, year after year, a worse place to live in. Every year I got less hope. Every year I looked forward to things with much less excitement. In other words, I'd look forward to the year, you know, it'd be New Year's Eve. Okay, now it's 1961. And I'd go, boy, there's going to be a 4th of July this year, there's going to be your birthday, and there's going to be all that, and I would just go, I hope I don't see any of them. You know what I mean? There was just nothing to look forward to. I wasn't looking forward to my kids' birthdays, I wasn't looking forward to them growing up, because I knew I was going to be me again. It would be their birthday, and I would screw it up again. It would be the PTA meeting, and I'm supposed to be there, and I'd puke on somebody. You know what I mean? I knew, I had stopped near the end, I had stopped telling myself, you're going to straighten out. You know what I mean? I think in our illness, somewhere along the line, we go, you know, you're not going to straighten out. For a while, I would go, well, this year it's going to be different. I'm going to be... And I finally stopped doing that, because I had no sign that it was going to be different. And so the future just looked dreadful. It was just going to be survivalville. And all of a sudden, it was me against them. You know what I mean? It was just the Lone Ranger. And the more things that went wrong, the more I thought I had to protect myself. And I protected myself by withdrawing. I didn't have friends. The last year of my drinking, I was overseas, and when I first got there, I said, I'm going to meet some of these guys, and I'm going to try and get involved with some people. I remember going to a officers' club. It was like a tent area, and they all sat around. All the guys got there at lunchtime, and we were eating. And I remember going through the line and getting some food and coming back and sitting down. And I started to eat, and my hands were shaking so bad, the food was falling off of the fork, and people were laughing. And I knew I could never explain all this to anybody, so I never went back. I started buying food and eating it in my room. And mostly I was just drinking. And it was just a year of surviving. The days were dreadful. I look back, there's some funny incidents, but the days, the individual days were dreadful. My worst memory was when President Kennedy was assassinated, which was during my last year of drinking. And they had a big ceremony in the hangar, and I knew that these ceremonies would last an hour or more. And I needed so much vodka in my system that it was imperative that I get probably 5 ounces in there about a minute before this ceremony started. And so I had planned it out carefully to get on my little bicycle and ride back to a Quonset hut to get this fix. And on the way back to the Quonset hut, this colonel that I worked for came by in a Jeep, and he said, "Hop in." And I said, "No, thanks, I'll ride my bike over there." "No problem, Colonel. Thank you very much for the offer. I'm trying to stay in shape, ride a bike, you know, make up some..." "Go away, Colonel, this is serious." And he said, "No, get in." And I went, "Oh, we're in deep trouble now." See, because the truth is unacceptable. I couldn't tell this man the truth. "Colonel, I need a fix." And so I stood there, and as the hour went on and we're standing there, the perspiration is just drenching my uniform, and the shakes had started in my knees and my hands, and as the Star Spangled Banner started near the end, I remember torn with the decision of, am I going to salute and my hand will be just like this, which will cause everybody to go, "What are you doing, your hand?" Or don't salute and everybody will go, "Don't you know to salute when the Star Spangled Banner is playing?" You know? Those are the wonderful little dilemmas that only alcoholics can get in. I mean, you know, I've talked to my father. He never had a problem like that, you know. And I remember choosing to just stand there and then explain this to people afterwards. You know what I mean? And there was no explanation. There was just that shocked look on people's faces as they just went, "I don't know what this is. I don't know why a 33-year-old man is standing here with this problem. Of all the problems in the world, what, this is so unreal." And so they are with the disease of alcoholism. But fortunately for me, the body gave out before the brain went all the way. And I ended up in with a convulsion and a seizure and the DTs up in the nut ward at Bethesda Naval Hospital back in 1964, and out of that hospital, after being locked up for 6 months, I got plugged into Alcoholics Anonymous through a Marine sponsor named Bill. Took me to Manassas, and that's been over 20 years ago, and I haven't been drunk since that Manassas meeting when I was sober for 5 hours when I arrived there and went through all the celebration of Pinky's anniversary and Pete and all of the food and the dancing and the square dancing, and it was about a 5-hour meeting, so at the end of the damn thing I'd been sober 10 hours. And on the way home, Bill is talking about going every night, and I'm going, that's 35 hours a week. I got to get out of this outfit. It's bad news. But it went along, and we went to meetings every night, and pretty soon 1 year, 2 years, and on into sobriety, and on into the journey of the 12 steps, which takes us down a road that I don't know about you all, but I never would have voluntarily gone down the road of the 12 steps. If you're new, let me translate something for you, because you may not relate to some of the people you hear in AA. You will hear speakers get up to the podium and they go, "Yes, I've been sober a while and I decided it was time to take a personal inventory of myself. And then I went and took a fifth step and got all of those secrets of my life out, and it felt so good." And you're going, "I don't feel like doing that. I don't feel like doing that at all. And then you will hear someone else say, "And then I decided to get into prayer and meditation. And I learned the prayer of St. Francis, and I did this, and I did that." And you'll sit out there going, I don't feel like doing that. I'm not remotely interested. I don't even care who St. Francis is. I don't even want to know that. I'm around people who seem to be motivated into doing that stuff. So I think it's important that someone get up here and translate for you. We have a little language problem here. When you hear someone say, "And then I decided to take a fifth step," what this means in AA talk is, "Then my sponsor said, I will break your arm if you don't take a fifth step." And then my home group said, "You may not come back until you do this." And I went, So I went home, and I decided to take a fifth step. So, don't feel like the Lone Ranger if you don't feel motivated into going there. What happens is we do a whole bunch of things that are not in our better judgment. If we followed our better judgment, we would go right out the door. What we do is follow directions, follow guidance. We follow the people who went before us, who are still here and are happy and are sober. And they are saying to us, "Would you like what we have?" And you go, "Yes." And they said, "This is how you get there." And you go, "Is there another way?" And we go, "No." "Well, maybe I can find one." "Maybe you can. Report back." "Okay, I will." And we go out and we explore every alternative that comes along. A book comes out of California, and it says, "Sniff Wheaties." "Right. Okay, I'll try that. I don't want to do an inventory. I still feel like committing suicide." "Well, come on back. We'll let you try the 12 steps. So through the process of our own elimination, whatever we have to check out every other alternative, we come back in great agony, pain, even with a bunch of sobriety. Our life is still not right. And we come back and go, "What's the problem?" And he goes, "You have refused to change. You're refusing to buy this simple program." And I know, "I just don't want to do that one." And well, it's the only one we got. And so kicking and screaming, I have reluctantly followed the path of the 12 steps and have achieved the rewards that come along there. And I was talking about this Saturday morning. What I think it has meant to me on a daily basis, and I'm going to repeat something that I did say that perhaps explains Alcoholics Anonymous as I'm thinking about it today. And it was my dilemma over a little prayer that I saw in the 24-hour day book some years ago, and I thought there had been a misprint. Because what it suggested that particular morning was that I devote a lot of energies into asking for the following request. And the request was, "I pray that I may be never satisfied with my spiritual condition." And I remember going, "Why would I want that? I want peace of mind. I don't want a permanent state of frustration. Why should I be asking for this? This is a stupid prayer. I know most of the times I like this book, but this one is asking the most outrageous thing." And I've come to think about that. "I pray that I'm never satisfied with my spiritual condition." I think that sobriety is a climb. That climbing up the mountain of sobriety takes effort. But the view is better. The view gets better every day. And some of us call it pain. "Oh, I don't want to go through the trouble of putting on the climbing gear and climbing up another thing." Okay, stay where you are. But we're going to let you know what the view is here. And you know when you didn't climb. At the end of the day, you just go, "You know, I didn't move." And so you live with the pain or the realization of not moving. And for practicing alcoholics, we fought our way to the gutter. We went through excruciating pain to go down. "Now I gotta work my butt off so I can go lower." We're puking and screaming and lying and hurting and fighting and punching and going to jail and making less money every year on our journey to the gutter with no view. Then we come here, and it is suggested that we put a little effort in to going the other way, and we go, "Why?" And we go, well, there's no pain, no gain. I don't like that saying. Fine. Do you like the view? No, I don't like the view either. Why don't you change your mind about the saying? So there it is. The point about this pain, effort, whatever you want to call it, after you get there, at the end of the day's journey, if you put it in, you reclassify it as effort, because it took you somewhere. You know what I mean? It made sense. It was a sense of accomplishment. And I guess what that prayer was saying is, I hope I never become satisfied with the view so that I stop climbing. Because this higher power that has given us this program has a plan for us, has a road for us to follow. And we have the, I think there's two components that I've noticed in my sobriety. It seems to come in two parts. One of them is following the 12 steps. The 12 steps are a mechanical, time-tested, proven way for human beings to improve their spiritual life. They were borrowed from religions, psychologies, philosophies, and they just got assembled in some miraculous order and in a rather unusual and unique way. The manner in which these principles are presented here in Alcoholics Anonymous are truly miraculous, because they just keep us around long enough to try them. And they take us along and enable us to start getting some guidance. I call it that inner voice, that thing I didn't want to listen to before, the thing that I was in conflict with. I think inside of each person, even the newest person here, is a fundamental goodness, is a fundamental idea of being a good person, of being a friend, of reaching out. And you experience it at a meeting when someone newer than you arrives and you feel something in your heart for that person and you go, what was that weird feeling? Because we've been denying that part of us all those years in drinking. We've been denying that we were good and we had any of those qualities. And the program and the 12 steps is like a gold mining operation. And it cuts right through all of those character defects and goes for this little spark in there that can be ignited, cultured, developed, and then it starts sending more signals to us. And I have a thing that I call, it occurs to me. And I don't know where these things come from. You're driving along in your car and all of a sudden it occurs to you to call your long lost sister that you haven't called in a long time. And you go home that night and you call her up and she's so happy to hear from you. It's like she was almost expecting it, and it fixed something that had been broken for a lot of years. And then it occurs to you that you owe some guy some money from 15 years ago. And instead of rejecting all these things, we start acting on them. I have found the end of a day, if I've had a lousy day, I probably rejected something I thought of doing. You know, something occurred to me that I ought to do, and I went, no. It occurred to me I ought to go over to the inner group and sign up for, no. You know what I mean? It came, where the hell, why, if that only didn't occur to me, I wouldn't be in conflict. You know what I mean? Please, could I stop these good thoughts from coming? That was the old way. And in the program, we start acting on them. And then, at the end of that day, we are going and sitting down with a much better person. You know what I mean? And get the feeling that life is indeed working. And all that is happening is we are changing. And the program is a process of change. It is an endless series of getting rid of ideas that just were wrong. In closing, I would call up the thoughts of Charlie Bruton that a lot of you folks may have known years ago. And he said, it isn't so much the things that we don't know that hurt us, it's knowing things for sure that just ain't so. And I knew a lot of things for sure that weren't so. And the most central key thing that I knew for sure that wasn't true was that there wasn't a God that loved me. And as soon as I was willing to change my mind about that, oh, did the jackpot hit. And if you're new, I'm suggesting that you follow the advice that's in the chapter of the agnostic. Change your mind. Thanks a lot.